Hi, everyone. You're listening to Potential Energy, the place where science, technology, and economics of energy come together. I am your host, Kirsten Sanford, and on today's show, we're talking about the water energy nexus. I'm joined in the studio by Alex Lindsay.
Hello, hello.
Hello, hello. It's great to have you here.
It's good to be back.
Yeah. And we are joined on Skype by Professor Mark Shannon.
Hello.
Hi. I know that you introduced yourself once before during our last conversation, but if you could give a brief introduction of your area of expertise, I would appreciate that.
Sure. I'm a professor at the University of Illinois in Urbana-Champaign, surrounded by lovely corn and soybean fields that have now been harvested. But I am a director of the National Science Foundation Science and Technology Center, Advanced Materials for the Purification of Water with Systems, a long name, but we call ourselves the Water Campus. And this is our headquarters. It's a national center that has universities, MIT, Yale, Rutgers, Clark Atlanta, Rose Holman, Notre Dame, Michigan, UCLA, Berkeley, and I hope I didn't miss anybody. So we have, and we have partners at Sandia National Laboratory in both Livermore, California, and Albuquerque, New Mexico, and Lawrence Livermore National Laboratories, as well as the EPA's NIRMAL, which is their research laboratories in Cincinnati, Ohio, and then the Chicago Wastewater District, the Greater District of Chicago. So those are our partners throughout the United States. And so we're devoted to coming up with new technologies for purifying water for human use, which includes all sources from drinking water to process industrial to energy to wastewater to storm sewer. So if it has something to do with humans, we do it.
That is extensive. Wow. We are also joined by Matt Rees. He is from the Water Environment Federation. Hi, Matt.
Hi, how are you?
Great. How are you doing? Can you give us a little introduction of your expertise and what you're doing over there at the Water Environment Federation?
Sure. I am an environmental engineer, and I am the managing director of technical and educational services here at the Water Environment Federation. The Federation is a not-for-profit technical and educational organization with over 35,000 individual members. And our mission is no less than to preserve and enhance the global water environment. We typically work with municipal and industrial wastewater treatment utilities involved in education and training for them. We put on a number of conferences, webcasts, we publish books and journals. We work on other issues, including stormwater collection, treatment management, and the larger issues of watershed management. And since we last spoke, we held our annual conference, WEFTEC, the Water Environment Federation Technology Exhibition and Conference. We had almost 22,000 people come together in Chicago. It was our largest ever conference, and we looked at all different aspects of water quality, treatment, management. But coming out of that, and I think relevant to our discussion here, is that there was really quite a bit of buzz around topics related to sustainability and specifically energy. And I will get into some of the details of this later, but we had a very interesting meeting on algae to fuel and looking at algae as a biofuel product and it's the impacts it has on water, which is why it was being discussed at the Water Environment Federation's conference. So there's a definitely extremely high level of interest in this in our sector.
It sounds like, once you start thinking about it, there really is just such an overlap between, you know, all these various energy sources and water use. There really is almost no energy production with our current technologies without use of water. And that's why this is such an important topic to be discussed. And I'm hoping over the course of the next hour that as we're discussing this, you know, you'll be able to bring in some of the discussions you probably had at the conference. And Mark, you've also been traveling the globe discussing these issues with people. I'm hoping that you can bring some of those conversations to bear in what we're discussing today.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So there was some science news recently that researchers in Texas, we're actually looking at the amount of water utilized and consumed during the production and use of different fuels. And they found that vehicles powered by hydrogen and electricity used more water than those powered by petroleum directly. And this seems to really get at the crux of our topic. According to Sandia National Lab's website related to the water-energy nexus, they say that energy production requires a reliable, abundant, and predictable source of water, a resource that is already in short supply throughout much of the U.S. and the world. The electricity industry is second only to agriculture as the largest user of water in the United States. Electricity production from fossil fuels and nuclear energy requires 190,000 million gallons of water per day, accounting for 39% of all fresh water withdrawals in the nation, with 71% of that going to fossil fuel electricity generation alone. Coal, the most abundant fossil fuel, currently accounts for 52% of U.S. electricity generation, and each kilowatt hour generated from coal requires withdrawal of 25 gallons of water. That means U.S. citizens may indirectly depend upon as much water turning on the lights and running appliances as they directly use taking showers and watering lawns. According to the 2001 National Energy Policy, our growing population and economy will require 393,000 megawatts of new generating capacity, or 1,300 to 1,900 new power plants, more than one built each week by the year 2020, putting further strain on the nation's water resources. And to me, like, this is just jarring, the numbers that I saw on this website. And I really don't know how many people in the United States are aware of this impending problem. So to start, I mean, the first question really is, where is the water going to come from? Do either of you have any insights into this?
Wow. Well, that's the actually $1 trillion question.
Yeah.
It is stunning, and most people don't really realize what type of impact this is having. And I'm going to use one of my travels just recently to China to bring to bear on this. China is building a new power plant every week, mostly all coal-fired, and they're using river water as their coolant. And so many have been built recently along the Yellow River that the Yellow River, the loss and output to the Yellow River is such that it's not even running to the sea completely at all times now. And if you had gone back not that far back in the future, in the past, you would have realized that people would have thought that's not possible. But it is, in fact, happening. And so they're looking at doing massive, absolutely massive water projects where they're going to be moving water across huge distances throughout China from one area to the other in order to try to alleviate some of the water demand problems in Beijing and northern China.
Well, and this puts a whole new demand on the energy. It's kind of a vicious cycle, isn't it?
It is exactly. It's exactly that. Because, and if you want, you think, oh, well, it's only China. I was just at the meeting in Chicago, actually, where Pat... I'm trying to remember Pat's last name. Mulroy? She's
Pat Mulroy.
Yeah, there you go.
From Las Vegas.
Yes, from the Southern Nevada water thing. She said she'd just come back with a meeting from the nine water utilities that use the water coming out of Lake Mead. 4 million people from Southern Nevada, 6 million from Arizona, and 20 million from California. And they are looking at this, the demand on water and the supply drop as being so critical that she says there's a finite chance, and not a very, very small chance, but a finite chance between 3 and 6 years that the water level in Lake Mead will drop below the intake, and that this will cut off water for huge numbers of people, as well as dropping power production from the hydroelectric plants. And so they said, so what was their solution? They went above in a lodge high in the High Sierras and spent 3 days without internet and phone, she says, and related to the fact they came out and they decided that they needed to move 11 million acre feet, and I forgot how many gallons there are in an acre feet, something like 325,000 if I remember right, from a portion of the Missouri River up over the Continental Divide to
wow, that's insane.
Colorado River system. And wow. It was a stunning assertion, but now it's I've seen it in the papers now as being moving forward as a plan. I did a quick calculation, and it came out that it would take some nearly 10 quadrillion BTUs, which is about 1/4 of all the oil we import into this country a year, to move that water per year. So that's that connection. If you're going to take a huge amount of energy to do that, as well as a cost. So I think this issue of energy and water is, you know, tightly connected, as that example. So it's not just China that's talking about doing this.
Right. Hey, Kirsten, you asked where would the water come from, and my answer is I don't know. And I guess if I knew that, I'd be a rich man, but the problem is that there isn't necessarily more water for us to work with here. And in fact, the water that we have is being used up quicker and quicker as population grows, as we're using more and more for all kinds of uses.
Well, and I think...
go ahead.
We touched on this in the previous episode, but the one of the issues to separate is also it's the access to clean water, right? Because we have a certain amount of water floating around, but you know it's the question is varying degrees of usability. What kind of water is necessary for these plants, for instance, to run? Is it can they run on gray water, or do they need clean water to run?
Well, you don't necessarily need potable water or extremely clean water to, for example, use for cooling for much of the energy production. Mm-hmm. And I think the larger issue here is not actually one of water quality as much as water quantity.
Wow.
And there's this vicious cycle happening here of we're seeing climate change and changes in precipitation and droughts in the Southwest and now in the Southeast and the need for power increasing, but as we start to increase more power through coal-fired plants and so on, putting more carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, you run into this vicious circle. Mm-hmm. I think a good question to ask is, how did we get ourselves here to begin with? Kirsten, you read off those facts, it's kind of scary.
Yeah, it's very scary.
And when you think about it, what's happened is, and you look at this from either side of the coins, that the planning for electricity production historically is not necessarily truly considered the water needs for that. On the other side of the coin, the planning for water supply and wastewater treatment has always assumed that electricity would be available and affordable. And, you know, before coming here to the Federation, I worked for a consultant for many years, and I designed wastewater treatment plants. And while we thought about energy efficiency, there was never a question that there would be enough energy to pump water around and to treat it. But we're really running into a shortage from both ends of the equation.
Yeah, particularly with the latest figures in California that up to 20% of the electricity used in California is used to move water from one end of the state to the other and treat it. And that is much, much higher than the rest of the country. And so how many power plants have to be built to do that or bringing it in from long distances? I mean, this issue is a really critical one, and it's not one that just us, that our country is starting to think about. I just came back last year from Switzerland. I flew there to wonder why, because I was wondering why Switzerland, a tiny country of a little over 5.5 million people, was spending more money in total than the United States in total on looking at the issues related to water and water and energy. And that's because they started looking at the water that they're a net energy exporting nation, this tiny little nation in electricity from hydro and nuclear, and they looked at the Alps that are the glaciers that are feeding it, the snowpack and glaciers that are feeding the water to their system, and they realized that at current rates of climate change that they were going to have these alpine glaciers disappear by 2030 to 2040. And as such, at that point, they would have to start importing massive amounts of energy. So they've started a crash program to look at low water footprint energy generation. And that's the only one I've heard of in the world right now. And it's something the United States should start considering in a hurry.
Well, are there certain energies that have a much lower footprint from a water standpoint? Like
yes.
Energy generation? Which ones are the least demanding when it comes to water?
Well, wind.
Yeah.
It's not zero, interestingly. People would think it's zero, but it's not. Wind has a lower water footprint per kilowatt hour produced of energy. Solar from photovoltaics, solar from solar thermal, where they have the high temperature towers, actually does take water because you need water for cooling water. Those two have a lower footprint, but among the different thermoelectric generation and power generation, they all have different values as well. Coal is rather high because you have to have water for cooling, and you also have to have water for scrubbing. Assuming that you're going to do what we do in the United States and use scrubbing rather than in China, where they don't do scrubbing, and you can see the difference in terms of pollution.
Yeah.
There are other ones. You know, you had mentioned the fact that it surprised you that oil, gasoline from oil, had a lower water footprint than hydrogen. That's because, interestingly, oil has a relatively low, still fairly high water footprint. Mm-hmm. So one can look at different technologies and start to consider it. What we haven't done yet in this country, in fact, most of the world yet, is to start asking what is the water footprint right along with what is the carbon footprint.
Mm-hmm. Ocean energy systems is one other power supply. And I think you had an earlier show on hydro where you talked a little bit about some of those systems, which it may be in the ocean, but relatively speaking, the use of water to produce energy is fairly low. When you look at where the U.S. is going in President Bush's 2007 State of the Union address, he had the concept of 20 and 10, and that was to displace 20% of the U.S. gasoline consumption in 20 years. And what did he talk about? Using biofuels such as ethanol, whether it be produced from corn or switchgrass. And that is some of the most water-intensive ways to produce energy.
Due to the agricultural demand, right? Just from
Absolutely.
Growing it and then transporting it and all the stuff that goes along with it that isn't even really involved in the actual conversion of plant matter to ethanol.
Exactly right, as well as, of course, refining. And a lot of this has to do with also in the refining, the cooling water. And I will say the industry has become a much more energy efficient than they were water efficient than they were just 10 years ago. But there's still many, many what I would call, you know, the sort of mom and pop refineries that were starting to spring up, where it was the lowest possible cost for cooling water and for you know, the evaporation and refining was simply to pump the water out of the ground, like they proposed doing in our local community. From a short distance down, it was very clean. You put it right through, and then you just deposit it on the surface. And so there's many of them who were using 130 gallons for every gallon of ethanol. But if you do complete water recovery, et cetera, you can get it down to, you know, 3 to 4 gallons per gallon of ethanol. That's just for the refining. Hmm. But it is very water intensive.
Well, and it is part of this that we're not really paying the true cost of water? I mean, whether it's an industry or whether it's us as individuals. And one of the things we saw that happened very quickly is, you know, we talk about people being, you know, that they should be saving the environment. Or, you know, a lot of people will talk about all these global warming and everything else. But what had people start buying Priuses had nothing to do with their care of. I mean, they didn't really. Most people who were buying Priuses were not that concerned about the environment, I think. I would postulate. You know, I think that most of them saw, you know, prices is going $3-4 a gallon.
Gas.
And it wasn't practical to have something that had less than 40 miles of the gallon, you know, and preferably higher. Is the fact that we use so much water partially related to the fact that we keep it so cheap to buy?
Potentially. And the EPA has taken a step out on this and looking at, they have something called the four pillars of sustainable infrastructure, and that talks about better management of water and wastewater facilities, efficient water use, watershed approaches, larger holistic watershed approaches, and finally, rates that reflect the full cost pricing of services. And yes, you're right that if we're not charging what it actually costs to extract, pump, treat, and get to your house water, and then to collect and treat again that water, then people will essentially abuse that. And there's no motivation for conservation if we don't have real cost pricing of water. So that is essential.
Yeah. Are there any estimates on how much current electricity prices would go up if we were to take into account the full cost of water?
You know, that's an excellent question. I don't know. I don't know what the cost is as a total function of the kilowatt hour produced. But without it, with current methods, you don't produce it. So I guess if you were to look at that price, it would be priceless.
And not to say that every water supply system isn't charging full cost price. Some are and some are not. But I don't know what the overall impact would be if there was full cost pricing across the board.
The interesting thing, I was in China and I asked the question at this workshop. I was saying, what do you think is the biggest problem with water in China? And I was expecting to hear pollution or scarcity. And the interesting thing was they said, because we don't pay the true cost of water, it's kept artificially low, and we can't do what's necessary for infrastructure, for delivery and supplies. So I started asking him what the price of delivered water was. And interestingly, it wasn't that far off. Many of the cities in the United States, such as Chicago and New York, et cetera. So, and again, in India, that was the key crucial issue, was the cost of water was to be maintained as nearly free or free, which is, you know, been the big problem. It's just not properly valued.
Is that just because, you know, water is something that's so essential for life? Is it just, you know, you keep the price low so anybody can have access to it? What would be the reasoning behind, you know, the infrastructure side of that?
I think social stability.
Yeah.
I mean, you start charging people a lot for water and they'd get, you know.
I don't know. We've got, you know, $4 bottles of water here. So
people buy happily. You know, it's a crazy thing that people are they're not willing to pay for it coming out of the tap, but they pay more than gas for it, you know.
In a nice plastic bottle.
Exactly. I think it's a very interesting point that what you're looking at here is this issue where, once again, another vicious cycle, which is that we don't have enough money to do investment, and there's not any reason for people to conserve, you know, and somewhere in between might make sounds like it could make a huge difference.
Mm-hmm. The question of real cost pricing with respect to water and availability, especially in poorer communities or poorer countries, becomes almost a moral issue. And I've heard the phrase, while people talk about water as being a human right, the service to supply that water, to collect and supply and get that water to somebody, that costs money, regardless. It's not as if we can all head down to our local stream, which is pure enough for us to drink from.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that,
we just don't live in that world anymore.
But I mean, I think we could make a decision about, you know, there's a certain amount per person or per location or whatever that's reasonable, that should be very inexpensive. And then there's, you know, it's kind of like we have a cell phone plan where I don't pay very much for the first whatever 500 minutes or 1,000 minutes. And then after I go over that, if I start wanting to water a 3-acre lawn with it, you know, it's going to get real expensive, you know.
So you have tiered pricing of water supply. And a lot of industries actually do kick into that. And that has worked, I think, to some degree, to get large water consumers, that's large industries, to take a look at conservation of water or water recycling, which is one of the ways we want to start talking about solutions here, is one of the ways we can look at where's the water going to come from. Well, we keep reusing the same water we're using now, recycling the water through the system, whether that be through water, through industries that are using water, or through other energy cooling solutions. There are technological solutions that we can try to apply to this problem.
Do you think that reclamation or new technology is really going to end up playing the largest role? Or do you think that they're both going to have equal standing in the way that this advances?
You know, I think they go hand in hand, because the use of reclamation for water or water reuse is dependent on the technologies to make water that isn't, and I won't even use the extremes here, potable water and wastewater, but to whatever degree you need, to whatever level of cleanliness or purity you need, there's going to be some level of treatment there. And it's getting those, in our last talk we talked a lot about the use of membranes as filtration systems. And it's a great technology. It's doing wonderful things to produce very high quality water. And those technological advances have allowed membranes to be used for water reclamation, even as good as potable water quality. The technologies are going to take us to where we need to be to be able to reclaim that water. So I essentially would say that they go together.
Mark?
I would agree as well. What we're going to see is a blend across various ways of supplying water from, technologies can certainly do it. Reclaiming water and reusing water is going to be where it's somewhat novel in the United States, will become an imperative where we will all do it. When you see examples such as in New York City where apartment buildings are being built where they recover the wastewater and use it for the cooling tower and for flushing toilets and such. The cooling tower, which is directly related to energy use for cooling, you're going to see these types of technologies so that the water will be used again and again. This issue is so critical, just so that people can get it clear the type of scale we're talking about. Recently, there was a lawsuit, 17 states were suing the EPA to try to prevent the permitting of a power plant, a coal power plant, taking water from Lake Michigan in Wisconsin, and they lost. And the cooling water for that one plant in taking out of Lake Michigan, it was going to withdraw, not consume, but withdraw more water from Lake Michigan than Chicago and its surrounding suburbs would, of 7.7 million people. We have 115 such plants permitted in the United States right now. And most of those are inland water. Almost all of them are inland water. If it was along the sea where you could use seawater, it has a different impact than freshwater. Countries like Israel, their entire cooling water for all their power is taken out of seawater because they're mostly a small coastal country. But we have to start thinking very carefully about, can we use dry systems? Yes, you pay an energy penalty for it, but that's where a lot of EPRI and others are looking at, where we don't have to use water, so much water for cooling water. Can we use dry towers and use air? Similar to your air conditioning system at your home, where it just discharges to the air. You pay an energy penalty, so it will cost more, but it will save huge quantities of water. So these are other techniques that can be done today. There's lots of improvements. I just came back from Toronto, where we're looking at new technologies for cooling water and cooling water towers to become much more efficient in energy use and water use at the same time. And you think, well, does that really make a big difference? You can, just by making new technologies, and these are some brand new technologies, it could cut the energy, both the energy use and the water use each by more than 10%. And that number, if you start multiplying it across the country, is a huge amount. So new technologies can make a play, but also more intelligent use of the water we have and the water resources we have, I think, is probably the most important thing that we need to be considering.
And when we talk about doing that, are we really talking about the biggest impact we can make is with industry or with individuals? Like, where is the leverage point?
Okay, so if we start where the real leverage points are, I go around, I give this talk around the world, but averages don't mean so much, but it gives you a clue. Around the world, 10% of all the water used is for domestic use for people, 20% for industry, and 70% for agriculture. Now, this is consumption. This is not withdrawals. That industry would be included in there is energy. It typically is easier for people with larger companies, bigger pocketbooks, to be able to take and adopt these technologies and these new methods. And so that's where the first adopters are, industry. But we can have a major impact on domestic use, because 80% of domestic use and nearly 80% of industrial use can be reclaimed. That water can be reused. Mm. Agriculture, you can reclaim about 20% of that water. But that's a very big number. And so we need to start talking about reclaiming, reusing, changing agricultural practices to reduce both water and energy use. And that's where we can have a big play.
Yeah, it seems as though in agricultural use, you spray water through sprinkler systems or through irrigation rows throughout the crops, and that water is going to evaporate into the air, then be redistributed through weather systems to other locations and not necessarily make it back into the groundwater supply in the location where the water is taken from. So is that the main concern there with agriculture? How do you keep the water within the local system?
Yeah, much of the water, if water doesn't go into the soil and then evapotranspirate back out through the plants or make its way down to groundwater, it's also running off the soil and into the water quality. It's a little closer to home from my end here at the Water Environment Federation, as we're looking at the impacts of excessive irrigation on water quality issues downstream. So certainly the ability to reuse or recycle in agriculture can have a big impact.
Well, and just 20% of agriculture amounts to more than the entire domestic usage, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm. So. Right. So that's why I'm saying if you can recover and reuse that water, you can have a huge effect. And the impact on energy, this is one that most people don't think of, and this is an issue of, certainly I would think the Water Environment Federation is very interested in this, is this issue of nutrients and nutrient recovery, which is becoming sort of a mantra that many of us are starting to use. How many of the nutrients, the nitrates, phosphates, etc., that run off in this water, that run into the rivers and lakes, and of course going through the Mississippi Basin back out into the Gulf, and the eutrophication and dying of the seas because of these nutrients. If one can recover it, and we're working on technologies that can do just that in large, efficient ways, you can bring it back. I even have a little bottle sitting in front of me at a desk where we've recovered some of the stuff where we get it back to a solid, which could be used as fertilizer. Well, if you can do that, now we don't have to use tremendous amounts of energy to make ammonia, which is the base ingredient that goes into most fertilizers. The amount of energy we use to make fertilizers is enormous. And then we use a lot of these fertilizers. The fertilizer then gets run off, and it adds more and more of this reactive nitrogen into the environment, which is very destructive to the environment. Mm-hmm. And so if we can recover the water, reuse, pull out these nutrients, we can reduce the amount of energy we need to produce the fertilizer to begin with, and at the same time, reduce the total amount of nitrogen going into the environment, which is so destructive. So from my point of view, we reduce the water use, we reduce the energy use, we reduce the environmental damage. So it seems to me it's win-win-win, and I think it also, we can start to show that we also reduce the cost it takes to produce the food.
Well,
so
I think that's consumer wins. The cost, I think, is definitely is the key factor, right? Because it's we can talk about a lot of regulation, we can talk about a lot of things, but the fastest way to move it down the path is to figure out a way that it saves farmers money.
Right, and how we can capture that value for the consumer, because if we can capture that value for the consumer, then it's a natural driver, and that's why I'm so interested in some new technologies to do nutrient recovery in agriculture, because I think it can have a huge play on water and energy as well as have a driver.
Right. A lot of the increase in food costs lately has actually been due to the price of increase in fertilizers. You mentioned the cost of ammonia, but there's also a lot of petroleum that goes into the production of fertilizer. Another factor that may impact costs down the road is just the availability of phosphorus. We've been talking about nitrogen here, but looming out there on the horizon, there are some people that are starting to talk and recognize the potential issue of global shortages of phosphorus,
Absolutely.
A key nutrient. And we do have the ability to reuse and recycle nutrients through our wastewater streams. The use of biosolids, which are a stabilized, the solids that come out of the wastewater system, which then are typically digested and stabilized, are used as land application and used for fertilizer here in Washington, D.C., in this area. Most of the wastewater treatment plants here produce a stabilized biosolid, which is just chock full of nutrients, and farmers are paying to have this put on their farms. There are benefits to this beyond a chemical fertilizer that have recently been discovered. So this all gets back to this: how do we take something that's a waste product turn it into something that's beneficial, and at the same time, we're saving energy, we're saving costs. The more of those kind of win-win situations you can develop, the further down the road we're going to get to solving this energy water net.
And before we poo-poo that, you know, some people will listen to that going, oh, yeah, we'll figure out how to do that. But remember, I think, if I'm correct, gasoline was a waste product when we started with it, right? I mean, when we were making oil and we were turning it into kerosene and doing all the things that we thought were useful, gasoline was this byproduct that we ended up with. Until the car showed up, we didn't really know what we were going to do with it. So, I mean, this kind of stuff can really go a long way as figuring out how to exactly what you're talking about is figure out a way to, there's oftentimes we're throwing stuff away that is extremely useful somewhere else. And it's just the key of someone either entrepreneurially or, you know, figuring out, you know, how can this be applied somewhere else?
Well, I just saw a couple of companies that are moving brand new technologies to trying to reduce the amount of water used in generation of energy in these cooling towers, again, in cooling waters, because one of the reasons why they need so clean water is because, you know, if you have a lot of struvite and other minerals in the water, it really reduces the amount of energy that you can produce, and you have to use frequent cleanings and use lots of powerful chemicals to clean out the cooling system, which is expensive, takes a lot of energy to do that. We lose a lot of energy just because you have to have, as you get these things coating in the pipes, it takes more of energy to move to get rid of the heat. And this number is a big number, by the way. I mean, we import a lot of oil and use a lot of coal in order to get over this problem. Well, I thought it was a really clever way to pull this out, where they took the minerals and did exactly what was being suggested there, is that we can make and use it as an agricultural product. So we save energy, save water, and get a product out at the same time. So yeah, it's what we used to be thinking of just as waste is not waste. It's a benefit.
Yeah, and I think there are a lot more people thinking in that direction now in terms of the reusing what are considered waste products. And this is, I think, also a crucial new viewpoint, a crucial new way of thinking about energy, looking at it from different perspectives to be able to come up with something that you wouldn't have maybe originally considered, but say, oh, this is actually going to save us, you know, X percent of energy. This is going to, you know, benefit this group of people that, you know, are needing this product that's not available at this point in time. And so the more that people are looking at these problems from this kind of different perspective, I think we're going to see some really interesting solutions coming to the forefront.
Well, and I think one of the other things that I think that the industry is going to deal with is, if they don't deal with it, this is, I mean, we talk about this with the environment and everything else, mm-hmm. but I think from just a bottom line sort of approach, if industry doesn't deal with this now, doesn't figure out the efficiencies, the reality is, I think most of us can see a trajectory where water is going to become more expensive. Mm-hmm. You know, water eventually in many regions of the United States is just going to become more expensive. And so if you have an industry there and you're not figuring out how to become more efficient with it, regardless of whether you want to save anybody any water right now, a lot of times with these big factories, it's a 10, 20 year curve to really get to really do anything sizable with some of this stuff. And so getting started on that now, knowing that it's just going to be more expensive, it doesn't even matter whether you're conserving water or not, other than just using less of it, because each ounce is going to cost, or each gallon or each ton or whatever is going to cost more, seems to make sense, you know, from a long planning perspective.
Yeah,
I think the real driver there is actually starting to happen when I came back from this meeting in Chicago, where it was talking about water rights and purchasing water rights. I'm trying to remember the exact name of the plant, but I can't, where they are purchasing from many people and the cost is going way up to purchase the water rights to keep the reservoir filled so that they can continue to produce hydroelectric power. Hydroelectric power is actually obviously a huge water consumer, but by storing water behind a dam, so much water evaporates and is lost, and that's why it's a big consumer of water as well. Most people don't realize that hydro is such a big consumer of water.
Yeah.
But the issue is that the cost to provide the water is soaring because of increasing demand, changing of the environment. So I think the real driver is going to be simply, if we want power, we have got to figure out what to do about this issue of water. And it is going to become a huge driver.
Matt, did you have anything to add?
I think this comes back to the comment made previously about planning and the need to look out in a fairly long-term time frame as to what the needs are going to be. Not only, there's so many pressures on both energy and water with particularly increase in population. We can do a lot of things with water and energy conservation, but as not only the U.S., but the global population increases, we're going to have more and more demand for both energy and water. So the need to do some type of long-term planning to integrate the not only the water supply and treatment, but the energy supply is going to be crucial. And if you look at options, and there's an example out in California, this is the Inland Empire Utilities Agency did a look at some of the energy intensity of potential water supplies, because they realized that they were going to essentially run out of water for their needs, and looked at all kinds of different options. And when you look at the spectrum, for example, recycling water that's already been used was 10 times less energy consumptive than using desalted or desalinated ocean water. And I know we talked a lot on our last call about desalination and the high cost associated with it. And it's very location specific, but you've got to look at your spectrum of options. And that's all part of the long range planning process.
Absolutely.
I wanted to jump quickly to the idea of security and the water energy nexus. I'm sure that there are probably some very critical issues that are related to particular water regions like the Colorado River Basin and the Rocky Mountains, Great Plains, various areas. Can either of you talk to the issues that are related to security and energy and water?
Matt, do you want to jump in?
You mentioned the Southeast, and it's a huge question. And security, depending on your approach or how you look at that issue, as the population grows in the Southeast, and when you look at, you mentioned earlier the Department of Energy had put some information together through Sandia National Labs, and some of their looking at energy demands for water resources, the population in the Southeast is one of the fastest growing parts of the country. I think in the 1990s it grew 25%. It also happens to be the area with the greatest water deficiency, as opposed to the northeast of the U.S., which grew at about 2% during the same time frame, and relatively speaking has much more water. So, you know, is there a, does that create a security problem for the U.S.? Does it mean that we're going to have to be importing water like I think Spain was doing? They were importing water from, I believe it was South America, by the tanker truck. I would hope that before we got to that point that we would have some type of almost crisis mode, where we'd be looking at other type of conservation measures so that it would not become a security problem, but rather that we could and should be able to address this through the technology issues we talked about before and through other alternative ways of trying to reuse the water we have now.
Well, and I think that the reality as we look at global security is that people fight over resources. we're fighting over oil in some places. People, but that's historically, the last couple thousand years as a trajectory is a big reason we fight is because there's something that we need over there, and people are willing to negotiate to some degree and then they'll try to take it,
Go ahead. Mark, I know you said you were over in Israel recently. You might be able to cover some of the water resources issues there, but you talk about water wars, and they're actually already happening. In Somalia, for example, warlords stand watch over local wells. They are the ones who control the wells. They're the ones who wield power, and they have all kinds, of course, of political problems in Somalia right now. But what's happening is that those who have access to the water have access to power there. And that's a bit of a microcosm, but at the same time, I unfortunately think it's a harbinger of what's to come.
That example, and this may be the first time people have heard this, and I was actually stunned myself when I was talking with representatives at the State Department from African nations. This issue of water and energy and security and food China is buying up large tracts of land in East Africa to produce grain because of the lack of water to produce the same grain in parts of China to feed their growing populace. They're bringing in Chinese workers to do this work and displacing people off the land and basically having the local government supply the, if you will, the military muscle to enforce it. And so this is becoming rapidly a global concern in issues of security, and certainly African nations and UN are beginning to drill in on this. This has got people considerably worried. In Israel, where I just came from and reviewing their water situation, their Minister of Water was saying because of what we call the Sea of Galilee as their freshwater source of water was dropping a meter per year, and they were reaching the what they called the black line, where they would have to stop taking any water out of, cutting literally millions of people out. And so since they're on a national water system, they would stop producing much of the agricultural output in the country. Since their energy comes from seawater and coal, it wasn't going to impact their energy per se, but it was going to definitely impact their food. This was a major concern. And then, of course, what the issue is in the United States with the Southwest, if 30 million people suddenly find themselves without their supply of water, extreme rationing is in the offing. And what would happen from a security point if this, in fact, many listeners might start thinking about right now who are listening, where they live and what they would do if they lost the supply of water. And, of course, the impact this will have in Mexico, and particularly northern Mexico as well. So I think the issues of security are a real one, and we see it in the world right now. And, of course, if one starts thinking about the Ganges and the Brahmaputra and the Mekong, as well as the Yellow Rivers, starting to lose their supply of water, where literally 1.5 billion people live on those waters and they become intermittent, I think we'll see massive security problems.
Boy, Mark, the story you tell of China going into Central Africa to grow grain to feed Chinese reminds me, it sounds analogous to the stories we're seeing now regarding oil, whether it's in Chad or Nigeria, the violence associated around some of the oil production and extraction in those countries from foreign countries coming in, setting up shop, and the problems they're having there. To take a resource from one part of the world and bring it to another part of the world that needs it. It may be oil there, but you just wonder if the export of food from Africa years or decades down the road is going to be in a similar situation.
Yeah, and it's really being driven by water. It's without a doubt is the main driver with the desertification as such. China is also looking in their northwest to having a forced relocation of some 30 million people because of the lack of water. You know, India is, we don't even know what to do about India. That is a situation that many of us are finding very, very difficult to figure out what to do about that. But in India, the issue is that they're looking at the amount of water energy it would take to really move large amounts of water from one region of the country to the other. They've already reached very deep distances down and pumping up water for agriculture and domestic use. That amount of energy needed to pump water up from hundreds of meters down, you can, you know, those who know how to do a simple calculation of multiplying the amount of water times the gravitational constants times the height, you can do it for yourself and calculate how much energy it takes. It's huge.
Yeah.
So, you know, we've got to solve this problem.
Well, I'm glad that people like you are on the task, and you know, there to know that there are, you know, here in the U.S. and globally, people trying to work together to solve these problems. That is a positive step. You know, at least people aren't just turning a blind eye and not paying attention. You know, it is important, and I it's good to know that our nation's leaders are on top of this in terms of research and policy. We're about at the end of our hour, so I just want to end this on a positive note and not, you know, scary, the water is going away and
please do.
We're all going to end up in water wars. Yeah. So could each of you, just as like a final statement, let us give me an idea of, you know, either what people can do on their own to do something positive to affect the solution, or, you know, what your, you know, where you would place your money on the next step in technology or advances that are going to help solve this problem.
Wow. That's a high thing. I think I actually am optimistic. I know it may sound what the problems are seemingly overwhelming, but I see a lot of innovation happening. People are starting to see and grasp the seriousness of the situation, and they start to see opportunities. And, you know, the lovely thing I like to say is the way we do things now, we're still a water planet. We're just awash in water, but it's just not water that's usable. And the things that people can do right now, and it may seem like it's little things, but if everybody did these little things, it can have a profound impact. Like, watch how much fertilizer you put on your lawn. You say, well, what is that? It takes a lot of energy to make that fertilizer. And then, you know, you water your lawn too much, you wash it out, and it goes into our streams, and it impacts the water quality downstream, water quality in the ground. And then we have to do more treatment, more water. So, you know, just be parsimonious. People put way too much fertilizer on their lawns. They can use much less. Watch how you water and use natural watering systems. And you can pay a lot of attention to what around your home, to your landscaping, and, you know, how you use your water and itself. And we're not even asking right here for major changes in one's quality, no change in the quality of life. I think that people can do, you know, you can go and you can Google water footprint, and you can start seeing all the ways that you can reduce your water footprint in the world. And if we started doing this and getting kids and educating kids about this, so when they grow to be adults, just like when I grew up, we didn't recycle. Now my kids, they wouldn't know anything but recycling. And it's just part of life. We can do these types of things and have a huge impact. If I was a betting man, which I'm not really, academics tend not to be betting people, you know.
Yeah, I know.
We move that way. But you know, I would put my money on the fact that we're going to see big changes in the way people handle water for the generation of energy, because there's no choice in the situation. We'll see many more air-cooled systems coming about so that we can continue to supply energy. We're going to see big improvements in the amount of energy used to treat water, and we're going to see large reductions in the amount of chemicals used to treat water. Chemicals take a lot of energy as well. And hopefully all these things will put a positive impact on the environment. So we'll have more fresh water in the environment, more clean water. We've had huge improvements in the past. You know, after the Clean Water Act was passed in the United States, we saw massive improvements. We've sort of tapered off, but we can see another real increase in that. So I'm optimistic. And in that sense, there's lots of problems, but there's lots of things we can do to improve them.
Great. Matt?
Well, if I knew where to put my money, my 401k would look a lot better than it does right now, I guess. there's so much that's going to happen in this country and for the infrastructure needs. And we mentioned in the last call the gap analysis that was done by EPA with $1 trillion needed for infrastructure upgrades. And that's everything from pipes to pumps to equipment in the water sector. There's just so much that needs to happen, and it's going to be happening there. But as far as what an individual can do, I think that general awareness of the impacts of what happens when you flip on a switch or turn on your faucet is essential, because people just aren't making the connection right now. And the theme of this hour was the energy water nexus. And when you save water, when you decide not to turn on that hose to water your lawn or whatever else you might be doing, you're saving energy. You don't have to pump that gallon of water. You don't have to extract that gallon of water. You don't have to treat that gallon of water. You don't have to then clean it up after you've used it. So you're saving energy by saving water. By not turning on the switch, you're also saving water that doesn't have to be used in the production of that energy. They're intimately tied together, and I think that fact is probably lost on most people. So there's a task out there, and that is educating the public. You know, other things that can be done is, I think looking at synergistic energy and water issues is something that, if we can find things that are beneficial on both ends, would be helpful. And on a very close to home kind of example, we talked a little bit in the last show about green roofs, for example. Something that can improve water quality, reduce runoff quantities into streams, and at the same time it helps reduce heating or air conditioning costs due to the insulating benefits. So that's kind of close to home, but I think on the big picture, as we talk about treatment plants and energy production, I keep talking about planning, and I think there needs to be better coordinated planning using waste heat from power plants and desal plants, or using biogas from wastewater treatment plants to generate power, and you're getting that synergistic dual benefit. And the more large-scale projects we have like that, the closer we're going to be able to get to a solution.
Alex, do you have anything to add?
No, I think that, you know, I always look at the market, you know, the market pressures, you know, when you look at something long-term, it's going to get more expensive. I mean, when we look at, I was talking a little bit before the show started with that, you know, my wife and I are talking about a car, and, you know, to me, it's not practical to buy a car that you can't plug in. You know, like it's just not, you know, it's not, it has nothing to do with, maybe something to do with the environment, but it's not the primary thing that I'm thinking about. I'm just thinking about, I don't want to pay for that. You know, I don't want to be hooked to one output. And I think that as a lot of our listeners, you know, the thing to look at in a long term, and I like to think about things in 5 or 10 or 20 year curves, is that especially if you own a house, if you own, you know, you might want to be thinking about these things, because eventually that price is going to go up. It's going to become more scarce. It's going to be harder to use. And you can think about all the environmental impacts, whether you're, and all that other stuff. But I think that the thing that's going to hit people in the face is as those impacts make themselves apparent, like what we saw with gas, it's going to get a lot more expensive, and you're going to, and a lot of people at GM, I think, really wish they'd listened to California. You know, I mean, you know, this when it comes to energy, you know, they really wish that when California was pushing them to make more energy efficient cars and make more, you know, to push more that direction, that they hadn't pushed back, that they had invested that money, that they had worked, they would have been in a much different position. I think in the same way, we're going to run into that with water. Whereas people who, you know, eventually it's going to be much harder to run your business or run your house or run all those other things on the amount of water that we're used to, and figuring out ways to do it now slowly and comfortably rather than as a big rush because it's now biting into your, you know, your bottom line, I think is going to be is worth paying attention to now.
Well, I think this has been a fascinating conversation. Yet again, there's so many things that people just really need to pay attention to that they are not currently paying attention to. And I think Matt, you're right. Mark as well. You know, it's awareness. And also, you know, as the pocketbook gets pinched, people might become more and more aware, and it might make some bigger differences. The personal responsibility, the industrial responsibility, the policy implementation, application, manufacturing, all sorts of things that are going to have to change. But I believe that with people working on it, there will be change that takes place. And I think that's about it for this episode of Potential Energy. And thanks everyone for listening. We'll be coming up in a episode or two with Carbon Cap and Trade, talking all about the stuff that might be confusing people, but that many people, Yale University included, think is going to be crucial to some of the energy troubles that we are up against in the future. Hope everyone's enjoyed the show. If you want to subscribe and download Potential Energy for free, we're in iTunes. You search for Potential Energy. Also, email us. I'm interested in hearing from you. I can't speak for Alex, but you know, myself, I love getting emails. Email me at kirsten@thisweekinscience.com. And if you have any questions, comments, suggestions for future topics, let me know. You've been listening to Potential Energy. Many thanks to everyone here at PixelCore for helping to produce this podcast. Lane, thanks for sitting here and being patient and doing all the sound stuff. Definitely appreciate it. And Alex, what shouldn't we forget?
Between now and the next episode, don't leave the light on.